please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Rachel Walensky, warned of impending doom because of a steady rise in U.S. COVID-19 cases. Walensky, who has been warning about troubling data on the number of new infections for weeks, said she fears that the U.S. could have another surge in cases similar to last summer's, mirroring spikes in Europe. She attributed the rise in part to the spread of more contagious variants, increased travel, and governors lowering restrictions too quickly. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, CDC Director Warns of Impending Doom as COVID Cases Rise Across the U.S. Here's more on this issue. Dr. Rachel Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said during a pandemic task force briefing recently that she feels a sense of impending doom as she watches COVID-19 cases rise across the U.S. in the wake of state leaders' premature moves to relax or completely lift coronavirus-related restrictions. We have so much to look forward to, so much promise and potential of where we are, and so much reason for hope. But right now, I'm scared, said Walensky, who warned that the current case trajectory threatens to derail encouraging progress in the ongoing vaccine rollout. While vaccinations are trending in the right direction, just 20% of the adult population of the U.S. is fully inoculated, according to CDC figures. I'm speaking today not necessarily as your CDC director and not only as your CDC director, but as a wife, as a mother, as a daughter, to ask you to just please hold on a little while longer, Walensky added. An emotional plea that came as the states across the U.S., from Arizona to Iowa to Montana, rush ahead with reopening plans despite dire warnings from public health officials. Walensky's remarks came as new data from Johns Hopkins University showed that the U.S. is currently averaging more than 63,000 new coronavirus cases each day, up 16% from a week ago. Around 970 people are dying from the virus each day as the U.S. closes in on 550,000 total deaths, according to the data. In an interview recently, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, attributed the rising infection numbers to things like spring break and pulling back on the mitigation methods that you've seen. During the briefing, Fauci said that we can't win this by just hanging in there a bit longer, echoing Walensky's call for continued mask wearing and social distancing. hang in there. As Dr. Walensky said, Fauci added, we really need to hold on to the public health measures as we get more and more people, from 2 to 3 plus million people vaccinated every day. Walensky, who has been warning about troubling data on the number of new infections for weeks, said she fears that the U.S. could have another surge in cases similar to last summer's, mirroring spikes in Europe. She attributed the rise in part to the spread of more contagious variants, increased travel, and governors lowering restrictions too quickly. She said she will urge governors again not to open up their states too quickly. The average number of new cases has increased by 10% to slightly less than 60,000 cases a day over the past week, she said. Hospitalizations have also increased, and deaths have increased by nearly 3% to an average about 1,000 a day. The U.S. has been nearing 3 million vaccinations a day over the past few days, topping the mark, recently said Jeffrey Zients, the White House COVID-19 coordinator. 73% of seniors had received their first doses, and more than one in three adults had received their first doses. He said the administration does not plan to create a vaccine passport that would allow those who have been vaccinated to engage in certain activities as other countries have done. The administration does not view that as a rule of the federal government, he said, saying it would be one for private sector.
Iran and China have signed a cooperation pact dubbed the Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. The deal was signed by the foreign ministers of the two countries in Tehran. The agreement includes political, strategic, and economic cooperation over the next 25 years. The pact would see Iran supply China with oil for 25 years. In return, China would invest in Iran's ports as well as its banking and telecom sectors. The pact has been in works since 2016 when President Xi Jinping became the first Chinese leader to visit the Iranian capital in over a decade. Many believe that the Iran-China agreement is aimed at standing up against U.S. pressure on the two countries.
Apart from this bilateral perspective, I think this signed agreement could be considered as a response, in a sense, in order to broaden the scope of the options that Iran has in its foreign policy, knowing the fact that Iran has been practicing negotiations with the Western side, and then after all these years, and after JCPOA was signed and sealed, and later on was kind of not effective for Iranian signatory of the deal, now there is this consensus among Iranian politicians that they should broaden the scope of their international relations, and obviously China is going to be one of the most powerful options to be taken into consideration.
The agreement drew an outright reaction from Washington.
How concerning is the emerging partnership between China and Iran?
I've been concerned about that for a year.
Biden made the remarks in an address to reporters in the U.S. city of Wilmington. In response, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said the signing of the Iran and China Strategic Partnership Roadmap is part of the active resistance policy. Shamkhani said the world isn't just the West, noting, however, that Biden's concern is justified as a flourishing of strategic cooperation in the East will accelerate the U.S. decline?
Well, I think the agreement that we are currently discussing could kind of pave the way for the U.S. hegemony to be broken, at least in Asia. And this is quite against the strategies that the United States is following in order to, let's say, increase its hegemonic power, specifically in Asia and particularly in the Middle East. So this particular framework could kind of, let's say, put the United States in a rather isolated situation, and could, of course, put China and Iran in a better situation.
Iran's closer cooperation with China, on one hand, can help Tehran shore up its economy against the impacts of the U.S. sanctions. On the other hand, the Tehran-Beijing alliance may be seen as a challenge to President Biden's China policy. This as the two major economic powers have been at odds over a string of issues, including trade, with each side having imposed tariffs worth of hundreds of billions of dollars on other side's goods. This stalemate has prompted China to increase its imports of Iranian oil to around 1 million barrels a day, eroding U.S. leverage. Many believe that China's new partnership with Iran is not a full alliance, but enough to undermine U.S. sanctions and rock the global status quo.
Whether we call it a strategic partnership or alliance or whatever you name it, the thing is that the very tangible consequence of this, let's say, new deal is that the world has to come to this realization that the calculations are, let's say, rapidly changing. And in this recent situation, the United States and its Western partners are not going to be able to consider themselves as the only powers and as the only superpowers of the world with respect to the new emerging powers and with respect to great economic powers that are emerging in Asia. And this is going to definitely change the context, not only in the Middle East and not only in Asia, but also all over the world, and new line of calculations are going to be met for the years down the road.
This as Washington has expressed eagerness to enter stalled talks with Tehran to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out Washington from the agreement, claiming Tehran violated it. This as the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has on multiple occasions reiterated Tehran's full compliance with the international accord. The Trump administration went even further by imposing a signature maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. All in all, it seems that Iran and China can establish an economic bloc if the Tehran-Beijing Comprehensive Partnership Agreement expands to other countries in Asia and through that confront the U.S. unilateralism.
On Sunday, people across the United States held marches and rallies to denounce the recent rise in anti-Asian hate crimes in the country. Protesters hit the streets in New York, San Francisco, Portland, and several other cities to show solidarity with the Asian American community. The demonstrations were held days after a gunman attacked three spas in the U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, killing eight people, six of whom were Asian women. The police are investigating whether the shooting spree was racially motivated, but the recent upsurge of verbal and physical attacks against the ethnic minority has raised serious concerns. The escalation of anti-Asian racism is attributed, for the most part, to the rhetoric adopted by former U.S. President Donald Trump after the novel coronavirus broke out in the country in March last year.
It's a disease, without question, has more names than any disease in history. I can name Kung Flu. I can name 19 different versions of names.
Why do you keep using this?
Because it comes from China.
Racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
But that's unlikely to be the only reason why the Asian community is increasingly coming under attack.
A lot of this anti-Asian violence and racism is has been simmering underneath the surface of the United States for centuries now. Trump is only a product or a symptom of what's been white nationalist and white supremacist legislation, policies, and ideologies that have existed within the U.S. for since its foundation.
Last year saw waves of anti-racism protests across the U.S. re-sparked following the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white Minneapolis police officer. With Trump no longer in the White House, many hoped things would turn for the better. But it seems like the former president has made a lasting impression that's proving hard to undo. The first instances of anti-Asian racism in the United States date back to the 1800s. The list includes the Chinese Massacre of 1871 in Los Angeles and the adoption of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which led to a sharp decline in the Chinese population in the U.S. Following the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1942, the U.S. government relocated over 120,000 Japanese Americans to 10 internment camps across the country, who lived under terrible conditions for up to 3 years.
The U.S. has a history of not only, you know, discriminating against Asians, but discriminating against anyone who was not white. Mexicans or Mexican Americans after the Mexican American War, or the history of enslavement, the history of genocide against Native Indigenous folks, and the history of barring Arabs and Muslims from coming into the country, or labeling them as terrorists or some other evil enemies of the United States. Every non-white group in the United States has really suffered institutionally and legally from the policies of the United States government.
Asian Americans are also encumbered by another set of biases in the context of their social life, that is, the stereotypes. They're generally regarded as hardworking, intelligent, and economically independent individuals. While the descriptions are mostly favorable, they hide other underlying issues, including racism, poverty, labor abuse, and psychological needs felt by the working-class Asian Americans. The model minority myth also hurts other communities by creating a paragon for them to look up to. Several instances of violence against the African American community sparked outrage across the country over the past year. The protests are now being extended to confront the issue of systemic racism and racial injustice against members of other minority groups in the U.S. This begs the question, can the cause be a force to challenge the deep-seated prejudice against the minorities?
Facebook has once again shut down the page of Press TV News Network, this time permanently, in yet another attack by the U.S.-based social media giant on Iranian media outlets. Facebook said in a note that this decision is irreversible. The company attempted to shut down Press TV's account without giving any prior warning. Facebook justified the act by claiming that Press TV has failed to follow the Facebook community standards. However, the company did not specify the so-called violations of its rules. The social media platform has, on a number of occasions, attacked Press TV, despite its own claim of providing space for freedom of expression. One such attack took place in mid-January, when Facebook temporarily deleted Press TV's page, which had more than 4 million followers. The news outlet, however, had its page restored after appealing the platform's decision to remove it. The attack coincided with Press TV's coverage of post-election violence in the U.S. Press TV has repeatedly fallen victim to censorship, not just on Facebook, but also on other fronts, including Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Over the past years, Facebook, along with other mentioned companies, have repeatedly targeted Press TV, among other media outlets of Iran, and the countries critical of the West and the Israeli regime's occupation of Palestine. It appears that the UK has also followed footsteps of the US when it comes to censoring media. The UK broadcast regulator Ofcom recently stripped the Chinese media company of operating on its cable network, an exact move that it did to Iran's Press TV back in 2012.
I think we need to recognize that in today's day and age, the various social media, in particular we're talking about Facebook today, is being weaponized in the tools of the Western powers to actually try and make sure that the agendas that Western powers have are going to be promoted, and anyone that is resisting or saying different things to what the Western powers want to hear and want other people to hear outside, they're going to try and make sure that those voices are suppressed.
In June 2020, Facebook labeled Iran's Press TV, Russia's Sputnik, and China's Xinhua news agency as state media, saying that it would block them from running advertisements in the U.S., which views the three countries as its arch enemies. The state media labels did not apply to the BBC, Deutsche Welle, or other government-funded Western news agencies, nor to those accounts funded by the U.S. government, such as Radio Free Europe. That is a clear case of double standards. Facebook had in 2018 targeted hundreds of accounts that it claimed were tied to Iran and Russia under the pretext of fighting misinformation campaigns. While American social media platforms do not hesitate to silence the voice of Iranian media under the pretext of policy violations, they offer a free hand to anti-Muslim hate groups and Iranophobes under the banner of freedom of expression in a blatant double standard policy.
I think the idea of freedom of speech within the Western world is something that has been promoted by the Western powers, and it's a myth. When you look at the detail of what's actually going on in terms of what people are able to articulate and the parameters within which they're actually allowed to operate, what you see is that whatever the flavor of the month is, whatever the fashion is in terms of the political fashion about what should and should not be said, then if anyone goes outside of those parameters or criticizes things that are outside of those parameters that Western powers want to have criticized, and they will not allow that.
Facebook and other Western social media networks have repeatedly attacked Iranian news networks like Press TV and Hispan TV, yet their allegations have been baseless. Therefore, there's a clear case of double standards. Western media cannot stand those who are critical of their policies, those who speak the truth, and of those who are the voice of the voiceless, as Press TV's slogan goes.
Friday, thousands of Yemenis rallied across the country to show their support for the popular Ansarullah movement and reiterate their strong resistance in the face of the devastating Saudi-led military campaign as the Yemen war entered its seventh year. People from all walks of life gathered in Sabine Square in central Sana'a since the early hours of Friday morning, waving the red, white, and black national flags. They chanted slogans against Saudi Arabia, which leads the military coalition against Yemen, and denounced U.S. support for it. Yemenis say the seventh year of the war will mark a departure from the rest, as the army has ramped up its retaliatory attacks against Saudi targets and made significant advances against Saudi-backed mercenaries. The recent spate of attacks seems to have had an impact on Saudi's policy in Yemen. Last week, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud presented a so-called peace initiative to end the conflict in Yemen, which would include reopening Sana'a's airport and allowing fuel and food imports through Hodeidah port, both of which are under the control of Ansarullah movement. The Ansarullah movement, however, dismissed the plan as fruitless unless the war ends and the years-long siege on Yemen is lifted.
It does appear that Saudi Arabia is attempting to withdraw. It has lost, of course, significant support from the United States for its war effort. So the fact that it has requested another ceasefire, although this is one that has been mentioned in the past unsuccessfully, but the fact they're bringing it up again at this time does indicate that Saudi Arabia sees that it is in a never-ending war that it cannot win.
Yemen says it will press on with its attacks until the other side puts an end to its aggression.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon, but even that couldn't stop the Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. While former U.S. President Donald Trump maintained close relationships with Saudi officials, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and provided Riyadh with abundant support, his predecessor, Barack Obama, wasn't free from blame either, as the Yemen war broke out during his administration when Joe Biden was serving as the vice president. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former president Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah movement. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia assumed to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions.
The U.S. has always been as guilty as the Saudis because it has supported the war. It has provided Saudi Arabia with billions of dollars of weaponry, which has been used to slaughter the Yemeni people. This has continued. The United States has withdrawn some of the sales that it has made to Saudi Arabia, but it continues with some others. So it isn't as if it has stop the flow of weapons to Saudi Arabia, weapons that that country is using to attempt to destroy Yemen. So the United States is complicit in this, as it has been from the start. This is nothing new, just because it's a new administration. The Biden administration mirrors the policies in this regard of the Trump administration, of the Obama administration, of the Clinton, Bush, going all the way back decades. The United States is a war-making and war-mongering nation. It supports wars of its allies if it will in some way enhance its profits and power throughout the world. This hasn't changed with Biden. It won't change with Biden. It's tragic, but the Yemeni people are continuing to fight and will until they are free.
Observers believe the Biden administration can only show its seriousness in ending the conflict by placing additional pressure on the Saudis to cease the violence and seek a diplomatic solution. Whether or not the U.S. is willing to do that to its regional ally is anybody's guess.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
the limelight.
Discovery that a white fly uses a stolen plant gene to elude its host defenses may offer a route to new pest control strategies, says Heidi Ledford, researcher, in an article published under the heading, First Known Gene Transfer from Plant to Insect Identified. Stay tuned for more. Pernicious agricultural pest owes some of its success to a gene pilfered from its plant host millions of years ago. The finding reported recently in Cell is the first known example of a natural gene transfer from a plant to an insect. It also explains one reason why the whitefly Bemisia tabaki is so adept at munching on crops. The gene that it swipes from plants enables it to neutralize a toxin that some plants produce to defend against insects. Early work suggests that inhibiting this gene can render the white flies vulnerable to the toxin, providing a potential route to combating the pest. This exposes a mechanism through which we can tip the scales back in the plant's favor, says Andrew Glass, who studies plant-pest interactions at the University of Chicago in Illinois. It's a remarkable example of how studying evolution can inform new approaches for applications like crop protection. The diminutive whitefly, which is more closely related to aphids than to flies, wreaks agricultural havoc around the world. Bemisia tabaki is among the most disruptive plant pests. Whiteflies sup sugary sap from hundreds of types of plants, all the while excreting a sticky, sweet substance called honeydew that serves as a breeding ground for mold. White flies are also vectors for more than 100 pathogenic plant viruses. That some species of white fly could owe part of their predatory prowess to genes from other organisms is not entirely surprising, because genetic thievery is common in the arms race between plants and their pests. Over millions of years, plants and insects alike have borrowed heavily from microbial genomes, sometimes using their newly acquired genes to develop defensive or offensive strategies. Some insects, such as the coffee berry borer, have plundered microbial genes to extract more nutrition from hard-to-digest plant cell, and a wild relative of wheat has pilfered a fungal gene to fight off a fungal disease called head blight. But plants and insects were not known to steal from each other before now. Entomologist Yujian Zhang at the Chinese Academy of Agricultural Sciences in Beijing and his colleagues were scouring the bee tabaki genome for stolen genes when they found one that seemed to have evolved not in other insects or microbes, but in plants. Further studies showed that the gene can transfer a chemical group onto defensive compounds called phenolic glucides. Some compounds are made by many plants, including tomatoes, to ward off pests. But the modification caused by white fly gene rendered the compounds harmless. test the hypothesis, the team engineered tomato plants to produce a double-stranded RNA molecule capable of shutting down expression of the whitefly gene. Nearly all of the whiteflies that subsequently fed on these Dr. Tomato plants died. That result suggests a new means of targeting whiteflies, says Jonathan Gresnan, a chemical ecologist at Max Planck Institute for Chemical Ecology in Jena, Germany. It offers an enormous chance to be specific, he says. You could keep the whiteflies away but not harm beneficial insects such as pollinators. Gene transfer between species can be difficult to prove, says a study co-author Ted Turlings, a chemical ecologist at the University of Neuchâtel in Switzerland. To do so, Zhang, Turlings, and other colleagues analyzed the sequences of similar genes in plants and determined that the whitefly gene was their evolutionary kin. The team also carried out analyses to show that the gene was integrated into the whitefly genome and was not the result of plant DNA contaminating samples. The results were surprising but convincing, says Yannick Pochet, a molecular entomologist also at Max Planck Institute for Chemical Ecology. According to the data they provide, horizontal gene transfer is the most parsimonious explanation, he says, but how the whitefly managed to swipe a plant gene is unclear. One possibility, says Turlings, is that a virus served as an intermediate shuttling genetic material from a plant into the whitefly genome. As researchers sequence more genomes, it's possible that they will uncover more examples of gene transfer between plants and animals, says Glass. Insects taking the genes from the plants themselves is just that last bit of the arsenal that we hadn't found yet, he says. In the battle between plants and their insect pests or pathogens, there are genes being drawn from all over the tree of life.
Around the world with reporters.
The Betel Futuh Mosque in London, one of the largest in Western Europe, hosting a pop-up vaccine clinic to boost inoculation rates and overcome vaccine hesitancy amid the many myths that have been created around the pandemic.
NHS approached us and they said with the idea of a pop-up clinic here, vaccination clinic, and you know we welcomed it. Our community has had an abnormally high number of people that have suffered from the virus.
We dispel the myths about microchips and blood clots and answer their queries. Some are really concerned about their fertility.
British scientists say there is a historical trend of lower vaccine uptake in areas with a higher proportion of ethnic minority groups in England.
A recent study found that a high percentage of people from Pakistani or Bangladeshi origins said they were unlikely to be vaccinated. Among black Britons, the figure stands at more than 40%, the highest of all ethnic groups in this country, meaning that some of the most vulnerable people are the least likely to get the jab.
And that's a concern for the British government, which plans to inoculate every adult in the country with the first dose of the vaccine by the end of summer. Online, videos distorting people's understanding of the virus and the vaccines abound. This one, that claimed silver solution kills the virus, was proved false by a news channel. Conspiracy theories have deepened public distrust in medical science.
Well, I think there's been some indication amongst South Asians for the Indian community that there might be some element of beef in the vaccine, that it might be unsafe. Particularly, there's been those questions of whether there's any pork content, porcine content, pig content to the vaccine, which there is not, but those rumors have been going amongst the Pakistani community in particular, which is large in our country, and they are false accusations.
Among some black Britons, a sense of unease. They don't trust the government. Some fear there might be different vaccines for black and white people. This week, a video featuring high-profile black figures urging black Britons to take the vaccine.
But we're asking you to trust the facts about the vaccine from our own professors, scientists, and doctors.
Vaccine hesitancy also extends to ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities, mostly over fears it might contain pork, or from the perspective of this controversial rabbi, popular on YouTube, it might alter people's sexual orientation. Conspiracy theorists exploit a lack of trust in the government and a health system that to some ethnic minorities appears to favor white people and the more affluent. The British government's challenge now is to build trust in the vaccines proven to save lives. Saeed Fariza, London.
Following a late cabinet meeting, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced his government's decision to reinstate a total lockdown on weekends in most Turkish states. The decision came after the number of daily infections with coronavirus reached more than 30,000. Erdogan also stated that during the holy month of Ramadan, the weekend lockdown and daily curfew from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. will continue, with restaurants only serving delivery and takeouts.
During the month of Ramadan, restaurants and cafes in Turkey will only be allowed to deliver food as part of the measures against the COVID-19 pandemic, as weekend curfews will again be in place on Saturdays.
A week ago, Turkish president had refused to tighten restrictions. He said, although the number of daily infections is high, the number of those hospitalized is less. Some criticize what they call the government's double standards in dealing with the situation, as it is preventing wedding parties and home visits, while the ruling party is organizing conferences to promote for 2023 elections.
Of course, infection rates will continue to rise due to the majority not abiding by the instructions. For example, when the government eased restrictions on restaurants and cafes and were all allowed to operate without preventive frameworks, people and restaurants themselves did not abide by the measures. However, you cannot ask people to be careful and follow restriction guidance when you hold popular gatherings to promote your party for the elections. This contradicts your own statements and measures. On the one hand, they stress the need to adhere to social distancing and the use of protective masks, and on the other, they organize public conferences with public attendance.
Turkish president said that 80% of Turkey's citizens live in high-risk provinces, including the capital Ankara and the biggest city in the country, Istanbul. The government now hopes that by the end of the holy month of Ramadan, the majority of Turkish citizens and residents would be vaccinated so that Turkey can welcome tourists again. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A new report on household debt by the Bank of Italy has highlighted that some 40% of Italian households are struggling to pay the rent amid economic difficulties linked to the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. According to the report, a large number of indebted families, 3 out of 10, and individuals, 4 out of 10, have said they are having trouble keeping up the payment of their rents or mortgage installments.
The work situation has worsened significantly, particularly for those who had a casual part-time job. For many, it's hard even to make ends meet. Bear in mind that pupils were forced to follow their classes online up to last week, and also for this reason, families have been under huge pressure.
Besides the economic impact of COVID restrictions, there are increasing concerns regarding the obvious effects on people's mental health. Many simply cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Not long ago, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, warned that some 5.6 million people were recorded as living in absolute poverty in Italy in 2020, an increase of about 1 million over the previous year. About 300,000 small and mid-sized firms that are especially vulnerable to the business disruptions inflicted by the pandemic have gone bankrupt.
Italy was in dire financial straits before the COVID-19 pandemic struck. It was the only G7 country not to have seen its economic growth return to pre-2007 levels after the global financial crisis, and its per capita income is the same as 23 years ago.
Siccome qualcuno parlava, no?
The health minister said all non-essential shops will stay closed for the entire month of April, even if the situation rolls back to normal. We disagreed with this approach. Shop must reopen. Italian must get back to work.
Meanwhile, a solidarity initiative to support poor families hit by the pandemic has been officially launched by the National Farmers Association Coldiretti. At least 20,000 households struggling in the middle of the pandemic will be receiving high-quality food products to ensure good meals during Easter festivities. Max Civili, Rome.
Along with a series of events held by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip to mark the Land Day, Palestinian students and youth community also organized a conference. Students, residents, activists, and resistance leaders attended the conference, which was held in connection with several countries around the world to support the Palestinian cause.
We are marking the 45th anniversary of the Land Day, while about 25 countries around the world are participating in the war. Their support for Palestinian cause. We are stressing on our right of return to our lands and that Jerusalem Al-Quds will remain the capital of Palestine. People who marked Land Day prove they will keep fighting the Israeli occupation to gain their rights.
On the eastern parts of the enclave, near the separation fence, Palestinians also held an event stressing on their right of return to the occupied lands. They also expressed their refusal for the recent normalization of ties with Israel and considered it as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
We stress that Israeli occupiers will leave our land by force, and Palestinian resistance won't remain silent against Israeli violations of Palestinian land and rights. We call on the world to stop the normalization of ties with Israel. That gives Israel a green light to keep up its inhuman aggression and crimes against Palestinians.
We are proving that we won't give up defending our land. What happened on this day is unforgettable, and we stress that we won't allow Israel to take over our Palestinian lands. We mark this day to express that the resistance is our way to defend Palestine and force the Israeli occupation to leave.
Land Day is marked every year by Palestinians since March 30, 1976, to honor those who fell while defending their lands from being illegally seized by the Israeli government, when Israel declared its intention to annex approximately 5,000 acres of land from its Palestinian owners in several villages. The Land Day comes as Palestinians are calling the international community to stop the Israeli expansionism and land grab, vowing they will keep fighting until liberating Palestine and its capital, Jerusalem Al-Quds. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
France is responsible but not complicit in the Rwandan genocide. That's the main conclusion of a report on the Rwandan genocide that the official Duclair Commission submitted to French President Emmanuel Macron. In 1994, extremist militia from Rwanda's Hutu ethnic group slaughtered more than 800,000 people from their own ethnic group as well as the Tutsis minority in a matter of 3 months. France intervened before, during, and after the genocide, but not to prevent it. François Granet, who is the author of The French State and the Genocide of the Tutsi in Rwanda, says the French government's report into the issue does not go far enough.
From 1990 to 1995, French decision makers decided to maintain Rwanda in their zone of influence. They decided to arm the regime and to support the Hutu's extremists against Tutsi before, during, and even after the genocide. The French authorities had been perfectly informed on the issue. Even if France did not have any intention to commit genocide, the French support had an undeniable facilitating effect on the Hutu's extremists.
Experts have proved that French authorities received many alerts during the ongoing genocide. In this video shot in Rwanda during the genocide, a French sergeant warns the French Army's chief of special operations that Tutsis are being massacred not far from where they are. But the French colonel does not react.
Complicity means help, and France allows the creation of an extremist government and its recognition by the international community. The perpetrators of genocide are welcome in France, and they find shelter in France and in Belgium once the genocide is completed. France delivers weapons before, during, and after the genocide. All this means political complicity.
Rwanda is a small country, mostly agricultural, with very few natural resources. No big deal. So why this was of interest to France?
France gives the support to dictators. If one goes down, the others will not trust France anymore. In the beginning of France-Afrique in the 60s, France abandoned one dictator and the consequences were catastrophic. Mitterrand and other French presidents swore not to abandon any other African dictator.
The report on Peres' role in the Rwandan genocide has other downsides besides trying to obscure France's real role. The probe was carried out with Parliament, where Macron's allies have a majority, refusing to give investigators full access to relevant archives. This new report highlights the responsibility of France in the genocide in Rwanda. However, this National Assembly refused to open all the archives, and French authorities still do not want to admit their complicity in the genocide. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
The European-wide Islamophobia epidemic has shown little sign of curbing as more countries join the criticized burqa ban. Swiss Muslims have been the latest to feel the effects of hate after a referendum passed banning all face coverings in public spaces.
Being free is to be able to show our face, respect women's dignity, have our own identity, and therefore I do not understand the discourse of people who want to imprison women behind this veil.
Following the ban, I reached out to Zainab, a German national who travels regularly to Switzerland, and asked how the ban has impacted her.
This ban makes me really sad and angry, because it's the second article here in the federal constitution against the Islam. I think we have to understand that it's not against the niqab or against the minaret. It's against the global Islam. It's just an Islamophobia act. And I think they are not finished. They are looking for the next step.
The ban isn't the first anti-Islam move adopted by the Swiss, as I found out after speaking to the Islamic Central Council of Switzerland.
I just can confirm you. I mean, Swiss chocolate is great. Even we Muslims, we love it. And Toblerone is now even halal, so it's a great thing, yeah? In terms of Islamophobia, this is less great, yes, indeed. Actually, we are indeed suffering since 2009, when this first referendum came up against the minarets, which has been indeed banned with 57.3% of the Swiss population voting yes for this ban. We are constantly, during the last 10 years as a community, have been attacked by the media, have been the target of certain stereotypes.
Local campaigners and activists have vowed to fight back against the ban. However, the global Muslim attention fixed elsewhere, the defenders of Islam in Switzerland have yet to receive the support they deserve.
The reasons behind enforcing the ban vary from country to country, with some claiming it's a security threat, while others simply say that it contradicts Western ideals. Now, whatever the excuse, the traumatizing effect that the ban has on devout Muslim women has been made clear by those who suffer from its enforcement. Robert Carter, London.
Another weekend of protests in the UK.
the southwestern city of Bristol, the front line of the battle against the British government's new policing bill that places new limits on protests. Demonstrators could face new fines of up to 10 years in prison for damaging a statue or memorial. The peaceful demonstration descended into violence at some point. Police were pelted, protesters pepper sprayed, and charged at with dogs. 10 were arrested. Thousands took to the streets across Britain. In Manchester, they blocked the tram lines. They were forcefully removed. 18 of them arrested. The UK police cracked down on protests since the murder of a young woman, allegedly at the hands of a police officer, has been under scrutiny. Critics have accused them of using deliberate and orchestrated tactics against the protesters. Last week, police retracted their claims that some officers suffered serious injuries during attempts to disperse a similar protest last weekend. But the government has remained uncompromising. Since the violent clashes in Bristol, it's condemned the protesters. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called the clashes disgraceful, and his Home Secretary Priti Patel described the protesters as thugs intent on causing trouble.
The contentious bill is still being debated in the UK Parliament. Critics say it gives draconian powers to the police, curtails freedoms, and does too little to protect women and girls. So far, the government has shown no sign of changing course, and those protesting against the bill say neither are they. Saeed Puriza, London.
Bahrain has hosted yet another Formula One Grand Prix. British athlete Lewis Hamilton added to his well-deserved fame by winning the first race of 2021. But in the run-up to the event, Hamilton used his platform to raise awareness about human rights abuses in the country. In November, he received a letter from the son of Bahraini political prisoner Ahmed Ramadan, asking for the athlete to help save his father from execution. Rights groups say he confessed under torture, a common tactic used in Bahraini prisons. Hamilton has since spoken to lawyers, Amnesty International, and the Bahraini ambassador. On the eve of the Grand Prix in Bahrain, he said,
"I don't think that we should be going to these countries and ignoring what is happening in those places, arriving, having a great time, and then leave."
But sports organizations have been doing just that. Civil servant Najah Yousaf was jailed in 2017 for demanding the Grand Prix be cancelled. That year, the event went ahead regardless, and for the next 3 years, Yousaf was denied legal representation, raped, and psychologically tortured in prison. Ahead of this year's event, 61 British MPs urged Formula One's new CEO to establish an independent inquiry into abuses linked to the Bahrain Grand Prix and to meet with victims and rights groups before the race to secure their compensation. Needless to say, that didn't happen.
No one wants to see their favorite sport being hijacked or used as a smokescreen for dark and sinister human rights abuses to continue unchecked. And fans have accused Lewis Hamilton now of politicising the sport because of his solidarity with the Black Lives Movement and his inquiries on the ongoing situation in Bahrain. But people in such highly visible international audiences are, of course, expected to be outspoken when they are benefiting exponentially from the public profile that they have, and they know that their silence will be seen as complicity.
Now Formula One has signed a 10-year, $650 million deal with Saudi Arabia, which, according to human rights organization Grant Liberty, has spent at least $1.5 billion on sports washing, hosting Formula E, the Dakar Rally, wrestling, tennis, the Spanish and Italian Super Cups, and European Tour Golf over the last 2 years. Amnesty International says, like all of them, Formula One will be used to sportswash the kingdom's, quote, appalling human rights record, let alone the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has killed and displaced hundreds of thousands of people and pushed a nation to the brink of famine. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A photo gallery was organized.